good evening once again. This is John St. Germain with the Crystal Silence League Radio Hour. Welcoming you to this Tuesday night, January 26, 2016. And do you know, when I was a little kid, and I imagined myself at 50 years old, I remember being 5 years old, and I thought, man, if I ever reach 50, I want to have a beard down to the ground, walk over with a cane, and be a grizzled old man. But here I am, a vigorous and virile 55-year-old, and I don't have that beard. Nor do I have the flying car they promised me when I was a kid. Where's my flying car? But enough of that senile rambling. Tonight, we have a wonderful show. We're continuing our exploration of the seven factors of enlightenment. And we're going to talk about the third enlightenment factor, which is energy, which I have very little these days. So let's take a little break while we gather our own energy, and that may require a frosty or warm beverage of some sort, and gather your crystal balls together, my people, my fine people, and join us in just a couple of minutes, shall we? Any crashing and thumping sounds you heard is that there's a wild cat rampant in the studios here at Castle St. Germain, so there's no telling what's going to happen tonight. Tonight we have the seven factors of enlightenment, and as always, I do talk during this entire program, and I would like to invite you, guests and listeners and good people, if you like to call in, our number is 657-383-0525, and if you press 1, I'll put you on the air, and we can discuss what we have been talking about. You can tell us your own opinions and theories about it, or you can correct me in any misapprehensions that I may be purveying. By all means, call that number if you like to be part of Blog Talk Radio and LMC Radio Network history. You'll be one with the ages. Just do that number, 657-383-0525. Press 1. If you have questions, comments, or mad ramblings of your own, we enjoy paranoid conspiracy theories here at LMC Radio Network. We love all that. Just give us a call. As you know, some of you, and some of you may not, Crystal Silence League was founded by our founder, as founders do. They find things, or do they found things? Claude Alexander Conlin, Mr. Conlin, in around 1917, for the purpose of distributing positive prayer and affirmation for all those in need of such. And this is done through a crystal ball, through crystal balls, and the pastors of the Crystal Silence League will project these powerful affirmations through crystal balls 3 times a day, morning, noon, and night. And I do that as part of my root work. In fact, when I get up in the morning, I do it up from my altar, and during the practice of root work during the day, and before I go to bed at night, I do the same thing. And the members of the Crystal Silence League also were provided with crystal balls, and they would receive these affirmations through the ball, and they were invited to project their own affirmations. It was a network. It was a network. It was an interweb of linked minds, internet and interweb long before the cybernetic web, which brings us to the rebirth of the Crystal Silence League, I think around 2009 or 2011, a few years ago, when adepts of the Missionary Independent Spiritual Church rebirthed it in cybernetic form. So if you go to www.crystalsilenceleague.org, And it's funny, people ask me to mail them that address, and you know, we're the Crystal Silence League org organization, crystalsilenceleague.org. It's really easy to remember. You will find us online, and you can post prayers there. And we get hundreds of prayers a week. I'm not exaggerating. That's not hyperbole. It is not hyperbole. It's not exaggeration. We get hundreds a week. Sometimes we get hundreds a day, depending on the political strata. And it's been my custom since we started the show to read a select few of these aloud on the air. We do not identify by name, only by prayer ID. So if you like, and I urge you to do so, join me in prayer for the following people. And I'm only going to identify them by prayer number. And if you like, you can go over to crystalsilenceleague.org and read more prayers and read these in greater detail. And if you will, just click on the button that says you've been prayed for, and they will receive an email letting you know that you're thinking of them. So our first prayer, prayer ID number 46991, prays for protection of danger, and prays for her mother who's having a surgery apparently. And our petitioner prays that her mother heals from this surgery. Prayer ID number 46990 needs relationship blessings for herself and someone whose initial is C, that they move forward with their love and build an indestructible, loving, loyal, and compassionate marriage. Prayer ID number 46989 prays for reconciliation in her marriage. And prayer ID number 46988 thanks everyone for their prayers. Says that her situation, which apparently is a court case, there's no changes yet, but ask us to keep praying, and we shall. Prayer ID number 46987 prays for relief from black magic that's being worked against her. As a worker, apparently, and prays that her worker is successful. Prayer ID number 46986. We have another court case and legal matter. This petitioner is being sued and trying to ruin her, and she prays that the court case be ruled in her favor. Apparently, they're using a dark magician against her, too. So, you know, that needs to be cleared up as well. Prayer ID number 46985 prays that someone whose initials are MG will love her and accept her as a permanent part of his life. Prayer ID number 46984 prays that GED will turn. This is a little bit contradictory. Basically, the GED will reach out to her with love. We also have prayer ID number 46982, needs money for bills. Prayer ID number 46981, needs help with her spiritual legacy, that the powers that she was born with will continue to grow and blossom. Prayer ID number 46980, prays that her son will stop smoking marijuana and will not involve himself in other alcohol. Then we have prayer ID number 46979, prays that her son will have open roads to build a solid financial. Prayer ID number 46978, prays that her child support will come in. And on, prays that her bag will sell on eBay. Prayer ID number 46977, prays for someone named M, that M and R have a close relationship. And prayer ID number 46976 prays that she always has enough money to never have to worry about finances and that her family will be in good health. Prayer ID number 46975 wants us to pray for someone whose initial is M. No detail. And finally, prayer ID number 46972 wants to find free gift cards and money all over the city of Parma and a gold card. Good luck with that. May all these good folks that post on our site find comfort and relief, and may their wishes be granted, and may their prayers come true. And let's take a moment of silence for all those in need, and those in need of comfort, and those in need of prayer. Hour where we solve the world's problems through spiritual means. Our crystals for the evening is wolframite, not wolfite, or wolfite. Wolframite is the stone from which wolfram is distilled, wolfram being tungsten. You must be cautious with wolframite, not to breathe its dust or ingest it, because wolfram, or tungsten, is toxic. And over time, people who've worked with tungsten or wolfram develop a wide variety of illnesses. So wolframite needs to be handled with care. Don't break it with a hammer and breathe the dust or ingest the little stones, and don't make infusions of it. Some crystals, you make infusions. Wolframite needs to be handled with care. Wolframite is a stern-feeling stone. It resonates with the root chakra, so it's a grounding stone. It imposes order and discipline into your life. Now, some people, basically what it does, if your life is chaotic and you're all rootless and scattered, wolframite is like that drill sergeant from Full Metal Jacket. He says, "Soldier, get in line, get your act together, quit whining, man up," and helps you with that. Now, I'm going to tell you that some people will tell you that or say that wolframite can take over your mind. Will take over your mind and rule you, especially if you're weak-willed, and that you shouldn't have it in your house, that you should put it in your garden, and that you shouldn't have it on your desk, and you should by no means carry it. But I know they make pendants out of wolframite, usually with quartz in the middle to help calm its rather commanding nature. So my experience with wolframite is not that it takes mental control over you, but that it will impose order in your life, and it's something that you should carry, not constantly, but in small doses. It's a commanding stone, very stern. It's like a stern parent. So wolframite is our stone of the week, a very powerful stone. Use it carefully. Use it, but use it carefully. Our topic, of course, is the seven factors of enlightenment. We're discussing the teachings of the historic Buddha, and we have been going over the seven factors, and we've worked our way to factor number three, which is energy. Of course, we talked week before last about investigation, how important it was to investigate the nature of phenomena, and before that, before keen investigation, was mindfulness. Mindfulness being in the moment. Being in the moment. So we're talking about energy. Now, this is a mental property. It's also the sixth limb of the Eightfold Path, which we'll also look at in this wacky little discussion we're having. Now, what we learn from looking at the life of the Buddha, which is thoroughly examined in the Pali Canon, that he was never subjected to moral or spiritual fatigue, that feeling where you just give up. from the moment of his enlightenment to the end of his life, he was tireless in his endeavors to elevate mankind, regardless of the bodily fatigue involved, and he did feel that. And he was utterly oblivious to all these obstacles and handicaps that hampered his way. He died in his 80s. He was an old man when he died, and he had stomach problems and back problems that are vividly described. He never relaxed once in his exertion for the common welfare. Buddha worked against the caste system. He worked to elevate the status of women. He was the first religious leader to start a religious order for women. Though he wasn't always physically healthy, mentally, he was always vigilant and energetic and joyful. So Buddhism is a discipline or a series of techniques for zealous people, people who are strong and firm in purpose, not for lazy people. And there's a saying that was drilled into me by the monks, Aradavizamasa Sayam Damo Nayam Damo Kutasita, which means the Dharma is for the zealous, not for those who like to sleep. That's basically what it means. The Buddha has not ever said, never does the Buddha says that he's here to save mankind from itself. Never did he do that. Never did he say he's here to take on the burden of mankind's sins or evil doings. In fact, Buddha said every individual has to put forth his own effort to work out his own deliverance with salvation. His last words were, all compounded things of existence are impermanent and subject to decay. Work out your own diligence with work out your own deliverance with diligence. He's a path revealer, not a savior. He had no interest in saving quote-unquote souls by means of a revelation. He revealed a path, not these truths. The idea that one person can raise another person from low to high levels of life and ultimately rescue him from himself or any other condition, this will tend to make a man indolent and lazy and often foolish, this idea that someone's going to come around and save you. Now, other people can lend a helping hand to each other, and we should. You know, we should help each other indirectly, but direct deliverance from suffering has to be fashioned for ourselves. We have to figure out how to do it ourselves. And we do this by hammering our heads against the wall of reality. This is what Buddha exhorted all of his followers to acquire, you know, diligent self-reliance. So if you follow the Buddha, you shouldn't under any circumstance give up. You should never give up hope, and you should never give up effort. Doubt is okay. It's okay to doubt and investigate, but despair is not something that's despair is just not good. So the function of energy has four purposes. One is the effort to eradicate any evil mindset that have arisen in the mind. Two is the effort to prevent the arising of evil mind states that haven't already taken root. Three is the effort to develop unarisen good. And four is the effort to promote the further growth of good that's already there. So there's of course, there's always a sutta. There's the Vitaka Santana Sutana in one of the I think the Majjhima Nikaya. Just as a competent carpenter or carpenter's apprentice with a slender pen will knock out, remove, and dispose of a thicker one, so also when through dwelling on some idea that has come to him, evil, unsalutary considerations connected with desire, hate, and delusion arise in the monk, then he should engender in his mind an idea other than that former idea and connected with salutary things, whereupon the evil and salutary considerations will disappear, and with their disappearing, his mind will become settled, subdued, unified, and concentrated. So, is the path of purification, the Eightfold Path, impossible for a lazy person? The answer, by conventional wisdom, is pretty much. It's not for a lazy person. You don't get there. You don't get there by sleeping all day and playing video games. The person who aspires for enlightenment should possess fixed determination. I've heard that used a lot. Fixed determination. Enlightenment and deliverance from suffering lie absolutely and entirely in our hands. But you must always, by your own resolute effort, rise and make your way to that liberty. And it's always in every moment in your power to do so. And in this sense, you find that the Buddha and Mr. Conlon almost say exactly the same words. Our abilities to rise above the common world lies in our own hands. It's in our power to do these things. The doors are not locked, and the key is not in possession of somebody that we have to outsmart or wrest it from it. That it just doesn't work. There are no locked doors. There are no secrets to any of this, and there's no deity that you have to pray for deliverance. At this particular goal, enlightenment, we can do it ourselves. So, by precept and by example, the Buddha was an exponent of the strenuous life. And again, here's the Buddha's words: the idler who does not strive, though young and strong, is full of sloth, who is weak in resolution, that lazy and idle man will not find the way to wisdom, the way to enlightenment. So, following in the footsteps of the Buddha, the disciple, the student, thinks, though only my skin, sinews, and bones remain, and my blood and flesh dry up and wither away, yet never will I give up my quest and swerve from the path of rectitude and enlightenment. Those aren't my words. That's in the in the literature. So, what about this energy? This energy comes from within, and bodily energy and mental energy are two different things. There are times when you're just so tired you can't go on, but somehow you find within you the strength to go on, and that separates as we say, the men from the boys, or the women from the girls. Can you find the strength to go on, or do you just quit? The fourth enlightenment factor is rapture or happiness. Rapture or happiness. Now, this is a mental property, and it's a quality that suffuses both the body and the mind. And again, this is said that if you lack this quality, you can't proceed along the path to happiness. The path of the Buddha is not for the weary, and it's not for the person of a negative mindset. There will arise in a person lacking rapture or happiness a sullen mindset and an indifference to the Dharma, an aversion to the practice of meditation, and morbid mental manifestations. So it's therefore very necessary that a man or woman striving to attain enlightenment from the fetters of samsara, the world, should endeavor to cultivate this all-important factor of happiness. And see, no one else can do that for you. No one can give you happiness. No one can give you the gift of happiness. It has to be built up by effort, reflection, and concentrated activity. Now, happiness is a thing of the mind. It cannot be sought in external and material things, though they may in a small way be instrumental to happiness. Happiness will not be found in them. So contentment is a characteristic of a really happy individual. Contentment. We're not talking about jumping them down, but contentment. The ordinary person, your average Joe, seems to think that's difficult to cultivate and develop contentment. you know, people seem to think that contentment is a condition of your condition, your surroundings. But by dint of systematic attention and thinking about the things that you meet with in everyday life, and by controlling these evil inclinations that we're all prone to, and by curbing these impulses, which are simply the tendencies to act without mindfulness, you can keep the mind from being soiled by unhappiness and experience happiness through contentment. You know, contentment is the key word here. So in our minds, there are these conflicts of diverse kinds. And if these conflicts are to be controlled, maybe not eliminated, but controlled, you have to give less rein to inclinations and longings. In other words, you have to cultivate contentment. You have to be content. It's hard to give up those things, though, that lure us and hold us in slavery. It is slavery that I'm talking about. And hard to exercise those evil spirits that haunt the human heart in the shape of ugly and unwholesome thoughts. And these evils are the manifestations of lust and hate and delusion, which you'll hear called lobha, which is lust, dosa, which is hate, and moha, which is delusion. Very important words in the study of Buddhism. You see them over and over and over. Now, until you attain, you know, the pinnacle of purification and peace by constant training of the mind, you can't defeat these hosts completely. They're always going to be there. But the mere abandoning of outward things, you know, fasting, spiritual baths, and stuff, they don't tend to purify you. These things don't make a person happy or holy or harmless. So you need. This is why we have before us the Buddhist path of purification, the Visuddhimagga, the Eightfold Path, which is divided into three sections: morality, meditation, and insight. The Eightfold Path divides into three sections: morality, meditation, and insight. So when we're talking about happiness in the context of these things, we have to keep in mind the difference between pleasure and happiness. Pleasure, which is pleasant feelings, is something very fleeting. So is it incorrect to say that pleasant feelings are the prelude to pain? I mean, is it wrong to say that? What people embrace in great pleasure this moment turns to be a source of pain in the next moment. And as it says in one passage, the desired is no longer there when the outstretched hand would grasp it, or being there and grasped, it vanishes like a flake of snow. So seeing a form, hearing a sound, perceiving an odor, tasting a flavor, feeling some tangible thing, cognizing an idea, moves us. We're moved by these things. We feel emotional pleasure by these things. And from these sense objects and mental objects, they, you know, we experience a certain degree of pleasure. You know, we see a pleasurable form, you know, a handsome man, a beautiful woman, work of art. We hear something pleasing, music. We perceive bread, you know, we smell bread baking. We taste ice cream. We feel something soft and warm and fuzzy. We think pleasurable ideas. These things move us. But all of these things are passing phenomena. They pass. Now, we're not like animals. Animals' sole purpose is to derive a feeling of pleasure from any source at any cost. We're not like that. We have the ability to gain real happiness. We have the ability to gain real happiness. And real happiness, or rapture, doesn't come from grasping or clinging to these things that are animate or inanimate, these physical things, but by giving up these things. Is counterintuitive. It's counterintuitive. By giving up these things that seem to give us pleasure, we arrive at contentment. And it's this detached attitude toward the world that brings about true happiness. And by detachment, I'm not talking about the clinical detachment, which is a psychiatric problem, but by not clinging to physical things as a form of pleasure. There's a type of detachment where you just don't care about anything, and that's that's a psychiatric problem. Buddhists care deeply about things, but Buddhists don't try not to cling to things. So the Satipatthana Sutta, which we read, the Foundations of Mindfulness, speaks of these things, these pleasant worldly feelings and pleasant unworldly feelings. And it talks about how the bliss of letting go is far superior to the pleasures that you get from clinging. Now, there's a tremendous joy that comes to you, to the person who ponders these thoughts. Others may harm, but I will become harmless. Others may slay living beings, but I will become a non-slayer. Others may live unchaste, but I will live pure. Others may utter falsehood. I, however, will speak the truth. Others may slander, talk harshly, indulge in gossip, but I will talk only words that promote concord, harmless words agreeable to the ear, full of love, heart-pleasing, courteous, worthy of being borne in mind, timely, fit, and to the point. Others may be covetous. I will not covet. Energetic, steeped in modesty of heart, unswerving as regards truth and rectitude, peaceful, honest, contented, generous, and truthful in all things will I be. This is conductive to full realization, to nirvana, to the fourth enlightenment factor, which is happiness. Let's take a moment for station identification while we ponder these things.
You are listening to the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ali. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. The longest-running conjure show in the universe, it may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time, Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner, starring Candelo Cambisa. This is the meeting place for all esoteric traditions. Candelo brings his insight as a Polero and eclectic spiritualist to his interviews with peers in Afro-Caribbean lineages, as well as representatives of numerous other spiritualities and religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. Tuesdays feature two wonderful shows to suit your taste. On the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance and tips on the practical use of crystals and crystal balls. His show starts at 5 p.m. Pacific Time and lasts for 1 hour. Next is In the Streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly provides up-to-the-minute reports on civil and social rights issues. Her one-hour show airs on Tuesday evenings at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. On Wednesday nights, Kai Armand broadcasts On Sacred Ground, a tapestry of our times comprising history, ethnography, and shamanism, featuring the voices of the land and the deceased, aided by scholars, spirit workers, and environmentalists. Kai's show airs from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. On Thursdays, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the professor shares his knowledge of roots, delivers the lucky numbers, and explores the secrets of scriptural sorcery. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. And on Saturday nights, come out and join Liquid Libations. Andrea Weston hosts this informal sharing and showcasing of poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances contributed by novices and professional wordsmiths. Call in and read your work. Liquid Libations may be heard on Saturday nights from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern, tax and license may apply, train departure times and Burma shape signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
And we're back. We rule Blog Talk Radio. We have more shows than you can shake a stick at, than you can shake a Queen Elizabeth root at. We are talking about the drawbacks of sensual pleasures versus contentment, and we can't deny that sensual pleasures provide a type of happiness. We can't deny that. I mean, common sense tells us that, and that's the thing that you're probably going to hear the most argument about. People say, "Well, man, ice cream, you know, chocolate cake. Come on now, you know, sex is good." You know, I'm the last person to knock sex. You know, I love sex, and Oreos and chocolate cake, man, and a good steak, man, and some cognac with that. You know, man, I love food. You know, I love this stuff. But I want to tell you, I don't cling to it. I let it go. And it was because of Buddhism that I went from 325 pounds to 205. You know, I lost well over 100 pounds because of Buddhism. It really fixed me. And it was I have a blog, in fact, you can find on my website about that with pictures of me, the amazing shrinking man on there. But Buddha addressed this. He talked about this. He said, I'll read you the words of the Buddha on this very topic. He said, "Now what is the allure of sensuality? There are amongst these five strings of sensuality, which five? Forms cognizable via the eye, agreeable, pleasing, charming, endearing, fostering desire, and enticing. Sounds cognizable via the ear, aromas cognizable via the nose, flavors cognizable via the tongue, tactile sensations cognizable via the body. Agreeable, pleasing, charming, endearing, fostering desire, enticing. Now, whatever pleasure or joy arises in dependence on these five strings of sensuality, that is the allure of sensuality. And what is the drawback of sensuality? There's a case where, on account of the occupation by which a clansman makes a living, whether checking or accounting or calculating or plowing or trading or cattle tending or archery or as a king's man or whatever the occupation may be, he faces cold, he faces heat, being harassed by mosquitoes and flies, wind and sun, and creeping things, dying from hunger and thirst. Now, this drawback in the case of sensuality, this massive stress visible here and now, has sensuality for its reasons, sensuality for its source, sensuality for its cause, the reason being simply sensuality. If the clansman gains no wealth while thus working and striving and making effort, he sorrows, grieves, and laments, beats his breast, becomes distraught. My work is in vain. My efforts are fruitless. Now, this drawback, too, in the case of sensuality, this mass of stress visible here and now, has sensuality for its reasons. If the clansman gains wealth while thus working and striving and making effort, he experiences pain and distress in protecting it. How will neither kings nor thieves make off with my property, nor fire burn it? Yeah, I just paid my goddamn taxes, I know that. Nor fire burn it, nor water sweep it away, nor hateful heirs make off with it. And as he thus guards and watches over his property, kings or thieves do make off with it, or fire burns it, or water sweeps it away, or hateful heirs make off with it. And he sorrows, grieves, and laments, beats his breast, becomes distraught. What was mine is no more. Now this drawback too, in this case of sensuality, this mass of stress visible here and now, has sensuality for its reason. Furthermore, it is with sensuality for the reason, sensuality for the source, sensuality for the cause, the reason being simply sensuality, that kings quarrel with kings, nobles with nobles, Brahmins with Brahmins, householders with householders, mother with child, child with mother, father with child with father, brother with brother, sister with sister with brother, friend with friend. And then in their quarrels, brawls, and disputes, they attack one another with fists or with clods or with sticks or with knives, so that they incur death or deadly pain. Now this drawback, too, in the case of sensuality, this mass of stress visible here and now, has sensuality for its reason. Furthermore, it is with sensuality for the reason, sensuality for the source, that men taking swords and shields and buckling on bows and quivers charge into battle, massed in double array, while arrows and spears are flying and swords are flashing, and there they are wounded by arrows and spears and nuclear bombs and hand grenades and nerve gas, and their heads are cut off by swords so that they incur death or deadly pain. Now this drawback too, in the case of sensuality, this massive stress visible here and now, has sensuality for its reason. Furthermore, it is with sensuality for the reason, sensuality for the source, that men taking swords and shields and buckling on bows and quivers charge slippery bastions while arrows and spears are flying and swords are flashing, and there they are splashed with boiling cow dung, ooh, and crushed under heavy weights, and their heads are cut off by swords, so that they incur death or deadly pain. Now this drawback too, in the case of sensuality, this massive stress visible here and now, has sensuality for its reasons, sensuality for its source, sensuality for its cause, the reason being simply sensuality. That's what Buddha said. That's what Buddha said. And it's I guess it's kind of funny to hear this ancient Burmese philosopher read like a southern evangelist preacher. But that's what the Buddha said. Sensuality is its cause. The misery of the world as we see it today, sensuality is its cause. All that stuff in the Middle East, sensuality is its cause. All this ridiculousness that we see in our current political race, sensuality is its cause. Even the more honorable emotions that develop from sensual attraction, you know, love, personal devotion, ultimately lead to suffering and stress when you're inevitably parted from the person one loves. All relationships end. You know, all love relationships end. You're with the love of your life. It's going to end, you know, somehow. And when it does, you suffer. Here's a passage from the Majjhima Nikaya. Once in the same Savatthi, there was a certain man whose wife died. Owing to her death, he went... This is heartbreaking, too, when you read this. Owing to her death, he went mad, out of his mind, and wandering from street to street, crossroads to crossroads, would say, "Have you seen my wife? Have you seen my wife?" From this, it may be realized how from a dear one, owing to a dear one, comes sorrow and lamentation, pain, distress, and despair. And once in the same Savatthi, there was a wife who went to her relative's home. Her relatives, having separated her from her husband, wanted to give her to another against her will. So she said to her husband, "These relatives of mine, having separated us, want to give me to another against my will." Whereupon he cut her in two and slashed himself open, thinking, "Dead, we will be together." And from this it may be realized how from a dear one, owing to a dear one, comes sorrow and lamentation, pain, distress, and despair. That story actually happened in high school. There was a couple. These two kids loved each other, and their parents were going to break them apart. And they parked in an alley and ran a hose from the exhaust pipe into their car, and they committed suicide. And here's the thing. Do you know why their parents were trying to break them apart? They were a biracial couple. He was black and she was white. From sensuality, all this suffering. From sensuality, all this suffering. So what we see all throughout the teachings of the Buddha is that complete knowledge of any object doesn't end with an understanding of its allure and drawbacks, but it goes on to comprehend what brings freedom and emancipation from the mental fetters, the mental attachment based on both the allure and the drawbacks. So the Buddha says, what is the emancipation from sensuality? Whatever is the subsiding of passion and desire, the abandoning of passion and desire for sensuality, that is the emancipation from sensuality. And I can't emphasize how important it is to understand this. I've heard people say, well, suffering isn't always caused by desire. If I desire ice cream and I eat it, my desire is quenched. And I sometimes just think, how can you miss the point so thoroughly? This is not about desire for a specific object. You know, if you desire a car, you buy it, your suffering ends. It's about attachment in general. It's about the whole process. The mind will, as soon as it's satisfied with one thing, it latches onto something else. This restless latching onto things is what samsara means. The samsara, the wandering, the mind constantly, the eye, the ear, the nose, touch, tongue, mind, always, always craves sensuality. Always, always. dependent. It's the fuel for the fire. There was a simile. It's a reciprocal nature of attachment. A person is bound by what he relishes and latches onto. The very act of relishing something is the act of latching onto it. There's one I gathered here. The Buddha said, "Venerable sirs, it is just as if a black ox and a white ox were joined with a single collar. If someone were to say the black ox is the fetter of the white ox is the fetter of the black, speaking this way, would you be speaking rightly?" And some elder monk said, No, the black ox is not the fetter of the white ox, nor is the white ox the fetter of the black. The single collar or yoke by which they are joined, that's the fetter. The Buddha said, "In the same way, the eye is not the fetter of forms, nor are the forms the fetter of the eye. Whatever desire and passion arises in dependence on the two of them, that's the fetter. The ear is not the fetter of sounds, the nose is not the fetter of aromas, the tongue is not the fetter of flavors, the body is not the fetter of tactile sensations, nor is the intellect the fetter of ideas, nor are ideas the fetter of the intellect. Whatever desire and passion arises in dependence on the two of them, that's the fetter there." Fetter is like handcuff. A lot of people, I'll say a fetter, what are you talking about? It's like a handcuff. A fetter is like a handcuff. So, in other words, neither the senses nor their objects are fetters for the mind. Beautiful sights, sounds, and so forth, that's not what entraps it. You know, let's not make that. Let's not hate the world. It's not the world that entraps us. It's not the eye, the ear that entraps it. Nor do the senses entrap it. Instead, it's trapped by the act of desire and passion based on these things. You see, it's possible to enjoy these things. That's where people make the mistake. So I got to go around always gloomy and not enjoying these things and hating them. No. It's not these things that are the fetters. Music is not the fetter. Beautiful forms are not the fetter. Taste is not the fetter. Music's not the fetter. It's the sensuality. It's the desire and passion based on these things that trap the mind. And even that, the appreciation of these things do not have to turn into this desire and passion that creates suffering. You dig it? So this clingable phenomena, which that translates from Taha, that offers sustenance for the bond of desire and passion, that's the bait that keeps us locked into this suffering nature. If you can enjoy something and let it go, you see, it no longer is a fetter. So freedom from sensuality as a clinging sustenance requires a two-pronged approach. One, to realize the true nature of the bait and to extricate yourself from the trap. And the first step involves examining the unattractive side of the human body, for one thing, because the Buddha said, now this is about sensual desire, "Monks, I don't know of even one other form that stays in a man's mind and consumes it like the form of a woman. One other sound, smell, taste, touch that stays in a man's mind and consumes it like the touch of a woman. The touch of a woman stays in a man's mind and consumes it. I don't know of even one other form that stays in a woman's mind and consumes it like the form of a man. Not one other sound, smell, taste, touch that stays in a woman's mind and consumes it like the touch of a man. The touch of a man stays in a woman's mind and consumes it. Just as a sack with openings at both ends were full of various kinds of grain, wheat or rice, mung beans, kidney beans, sesame seeds, husk or rice, and a man with good eyesight pouring it out were to reflect, this is wheat, this is rice, these are mung beans, these are kidney beans, these are sesame seeds, this is husk rice. In the same way, monks, a monk reflects on this very body from the soles of his feet on up, from the crown of the head on down, surrounded by skin and full of various kinds of unclean things. In this body there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, tendons, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, membranes, spleen, lungs, large intestines, small intestines, gorge, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, oil, saliva, mucus, fluid in the joints, urine." And he goes on with further descriptions about how the body turns into a skeleton and things like this. And it's not to develop a morbid fascination with the grotesque, but to correct the distortion of a perception that tries to deny the unattractive aspects of the body and to only admit signs of the beautiful. And oh, what suffering that leads to. You know, you see these people at the gym working out to build a beautiful body that's going to last about 5 years. When they start to get old, they deny it. They get implants and butt implants and breast implants and collagen and facelifts and all these things to try to cling to something they never had to begin with, and that is perfection, the idea of perfection. And what misery you have. Man, all you got to do is look on Facebook and see these selfies of narcissistic people, and you think, oh my gosh. What this leads to is a worship of an idea that things don't change. And one of the more insidious clingings of that we have are clinging to views. And these are thought objects. And this is one of the most difficult things to get. We get ideas in our head and we cling to them, cling to views, and that's view, rites and rituals. These are some of the more insidious things to cling to: rites and rituals and views. Views are opinions. These are beliefs. Now, apart from the actual content of these views, when you're attached to views, you're bound to get into disputes with those who hold opposing views, resulting in unwholesome mental states for the winners as well as the losers. You know, the winners feel pride and the losers feel grief. So, Nagarjuna said, who was a Buddhist scholar, said, engaged in disputes in the midst of an assembly, anxious, desiring praise, the one defeated is chagrined. Shaken with criticism, he seeks for an opening. He whose doctrine is judged is demolished, defeated by those judging the issue. He laments, he grieves, the inferior exponent. He beat me, he mourns. You know, there's really no such thing as a good loser. You know, you act like you're, you know, yeah, that's okay, but, you know, you eat your heart out. These disputes have arisen among contemplatives. In them are elation and dejection. Seeing this, one should abstain from disputes, but they have no other goal than the gaining of praise. People say you learn from debate. You know, all you learn is to be a better debater. I've never learned a thing from debating with people. He who is praised there for expounding his doctrine in the midst of the assembly laughs on that account and grows haughty, attaining his heart's desire. That haughtiness will be his grounds for vexation, for he'll speak in pride and conceit. Seeing this, one should abstain from disputes. No purity is attained by them, say the skilled. And another point is, attachment to views implicitly involves attachment to a sense of superior and inferior. You immediately begin to hit that duality thing, which is anathema to seeing reality as it is. And the criteria that's used in measuring and making these evaluations of superior and inferior become another set of views. And any measure or criterion acts as a limitation or another fetter of the mind. Any measure, any criteria, imprisons the mind. And the skilled people, the arhats, the wise ones, the noble ones, say that is a binding knot. That is independence of which you regard another as inferior. And when you regard another person's views as inferior, you're regarding that person as inferior. So we have more Nagarjuna. Whoever construes equal, superior, or inferior, by that he dispute, whereas to one unaffected by these three, equal, superior, do not occur. Of what would the Brahmin say, true or false, disputing with whom? And he who in whom equal, unequal are not, as the prickly lotus is unsmeared by water and mud, so the sage, an exponent of peace, without greed, is unsmeared by sensuality in the world. An attainer of wisdom isn't measured, made proud, by views or by what is thought, for he isn't affected by them. He wouldn't be led by action, learning, doesn't reach a conclusion in any entrenchments. For one dispassionate toward perception, there are no ties. For one released by discernment, no delusions. For one who grasps at perception and views, go about butting their heads in the world. And I love that last line, go about butting their heads in the world. And if you want to see the arena of headbutting, Facebook. What we learn is that abandonment of views comes about through knowledge, not through skepticism, agnosticism, atheism, ignorance, or a mindless openness to all views. Opening your mind to all views is not any good, but through knowledge, through knowledge. And that's made clear in several places. There's one called The Discourse of the Supreme Net. We don't have time to read it and study, but we will. The Buddha gives a list of 62 philosophical positions concerning the nature of the self, the cosmos, and the state of ultimate freedom in the immediate present. Maybe you should just look that up and read it yourself, because it is pretty long. Discourse of the Supreme Net, N-E-T. There are really 62 philosophical positions about Discord of the Supreme Net. Plus, he talks about eel wriggling, which is a great thing, eel-like wriggling, where people say things like, I don't think so, I don't think in that way, I don't think otherwise, I don't think not, I don't think not, where people don't take a position. And it's very interesting, et cetera. So what do you do? Well, the Buddha says, this, monks, the Buddha discerns, and he discerns that these standpoints, thus seized, thus grasped, that lead to such and such a destination, to such and such a state in the world beyond. And he discerns what is higher than this, and yet discerning that, he does not grasp at that act of discerning. And as he's not grasping at it, unbinding is experienced right within, knowing as they have come to be, the origin, ending, allure, and drawbacks of feelings, along with the emancipation from feelings. The Buddha, monks, through lack of sustenance clinging, is released. And when he's talking about the Buddha, he's talking about bodhicitta, the Buddha mind. And there's a list of speculative views that you can find, too, that are interesting to read. The position that the world is eternal is a thicket of views. The position that the world is not eternal, that the world is finite, the world is infinite, the soul is the same thing as the body, the soul is one thing and the body another. After death, a Buddha exists. After death, a Buddha does not exist. After death, a Buddha both exists and does not exist. After death, a Buddha neither exists nor does not exist. He says, none of does not lead to disenchantment, dispassion, stopping to calm, direct knowledge, self-awakening, and binding. And so, Vacha, the wanderer, who turns up quite a bit, says, does Master Gotama have any position at all? A position, Vacha, is something that a Buddha has done away with. What a Buddha sees is this, such as form, such as origin, such as disappearance, such as feeling, such as origin, such as disappearance, such as perception, such are fabrications, such as consciousness, such as origin, such as disappearance. Because of this, I say, a Buddha, with its ending, fading out, stopping, renunciation, and relinquishing of all construings, all excoginations, all I-making, and obsessions with conceit, is, through lack of sustenance clinging, released. So you see, when confronted with these big questions, the Buddha said, I've done away with that. What I'm concerned about is getting the hell out of here. Therefore, the Buddha says to us, don't worry about that stuff. Don't worry about these things. Worry about purifying your mind and getting out of this rat race. So, we're running out of time. Join us next week when we continue our study of the seven wings of enlightenment. And if you do get enlightened, please call 657-383-0525. Press 1 and tell us what it's like. This is John St. Germain. You've been listening to the Crystal Silence League. Thanks so much for showing up. We've had a full house tonight, and Blog Talk Radio has not let us down tonight. We're out of the Mercury retrograde, so maybe Blog Talk Radio will start working for us again. I hope you have a very happy evening. Stay tuned. We have more shows coming up, and join us next week when we'll continue our discussion. And you can find the next program, The Streets with Beverly Smith, and there's a nice link in our chat that you can click on and find it. And we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
As the in-stadium voice for the best hockey team in Dallas, I don't need a New Year's resolution to get up for game day. I've cheated genetics and turned back the clock. Thanks to Maximus, I've doubled my testosterone in 3 weeks. Do New Year's right for once with Maximus's New Year's sale. Save up to $360 on all testosterone plans at MaximusTribe.com. That's MaximusTribe.com.
Results may vary and outcomes aren't guaranteed. Claims have not been reviewed by FDA, and Maximus does not claim to treat or prevent disease. MaximusTribe.com.